Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. My name is Kevin Swanson, coming to you from my basement out here in the Eastern Plains of Colorado. And, folks, I'm a homeschool father of five. And I'm doing the best I can to salvage faith, family, and freedom in the 21st century. As the faith dies, as the culture becomes increasingly cannibalistic, humanistic, existentialistic, you name it, anything but the principles of God's law and a Christian culture that has dominated the West for about, 1,500 years, that's pretty much gone. And here I am in my basement with my daughter, Emily. She's in studio with me, and I'll tell you why in just a moment. But friends, coming out of this last weekend, we had one of the top blockbusters of all time. It was the Hunger Games that pulled in $155 million in the box office. Now, that's pretty much right. That's a springtime record, but it's been beaten out in past seasons by Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows and the three Twilight sequels. So the witchcraft movies and the cannibalistic blood-sucking movies has done a little bit better than the Hunger Games. But for a springtime release, friends, this is the best box office return in a weekend in the history of film. And so we decided to go watch it. And part of the reason we did this was because there's been so many of our homeschooling friends and Christian friends who have commented on this movie over the last several days, and they were very impressed with it. They're impressed with the books, or they were impressed with the movie itself. And so my daughter is involved somewhat on Facebook, and some of the friends that she's seen have some good things to say about The Hunger Games. They went to see it, and it was a great film, according to some. And so I decided to take my daughter, and we'd go see it together, because I was on the front end a little concerned. I have to say that. On the front end, I was a little concerned. Part of the reason is because I read Rolling Stone magazine's review of The Hunger Games. Peter Travers said, "The Hunger Games gets your pulse racing. It's about something pertinent, the mission to define yourself in a world that's spinning off its moral axis." So immediately I'm a little concerned. I mean, this apparently is one of the most self-consciously humanist men I think I've ever read, Peter Travers from Rolling Stone magazine, and he understands that the world is spinning off a moral axis, but then we all have to define our morality individually, and a movie like this, he says, encourages one to do so. For all its compromises, The Hunger Games is a zeitgeist movie that captures the spirit of a soul-sucking age in which ego easily trumps common sense. Ironically, the kill-to-win ethos that dominates movies from 1987's prophetic The Running Man to the undiluted brutality of Japan's Battle Royale in 2000 may find its largest viewership at The Hunger Games. But will mainstream audiences respond to the moral challenge churning under the pop culture razzle-dazzle? It's anybody's guess. So as I read this, I was a little concerned. And I have to say, I wasn't going to just send you down to that movie theater, have a good time, here's $20, and let's just, you know, enjoy yourself and take on the worldview and live your life and define your own morality. I wasn't really buying the Peter Travers line on that one, Em. So that's why we went to see this thing. And now it's pretty late at night, and we're about ready to record this program, and we're going to air it hopefully Tuesday morning. That is tomorrow morning. But I wanted to review the most popular film in America, and I think we ought to do that right now.
Okay.
Are you ready to go?
Yep, I'm ready to go.
Now, Em, as we get into the movie theater, maybe I haven't watched a movie in a long time, but one of the things that, just on the outset, I didn't really enjoy that much was the jiggling of the camera. Did you pick that up?
Oh, yeah, that was making me kind of get a headache.
I was getting a lot of nauseating.
I was getting anxious.
I don't
there.
Know what it was. It's just they jerked the camera around and it moves.
I think that
it
was
slides all over. It's a very postmodern form of motion pictures, I think. You know, I mean, people are just willing to be shifting their attention from one thing to the next in just what seconds at a time. So that was, I think, a little bit of an issue for me. But the story, of course, was about this girl in a dystopian world where it's very tyrannical, sort of a 1984-ish kind of world, and she's got to operate in this world, and she's got to kind of figure things out as she goes. And she's chosen to be one of the two people from her district that represents the district in the Hunger Games. And they choose, evidently, each year two players, 12 to 18 years of age. So these are kids. And so that's another thing that sort of makes this thing difficult, because it's a challenge to children. And I think there are a lot of teens that are watching this. I think
this is
for teens.
This is
for
huge
kids.
For teens.
And this is not the Hardy Boys anymore. We're not talking the Bobbsey Twins anymore.
This is intense. A lot deeper.
Oh, this is intense, yeah. Now, the ethical situation is rather complex.
Oh, yeah, it was really complex. Yeah. I could almost feel myself being drawn in if I hadn't had you there beside me to say, well, look at this.
You know, a time or two, I was a little concerned about you. And I felt like, and we were talking throughout the whole thing. I hope we didn't disturb too much of the rest of the
film. We had a running commentary going film.
And I think I made about 7 pages of notes
as I went.
It was difficult in the dark, but I just kept on. I had a tablet, and you saw I was just flipping through pages and pages and pages and pages. But what disguised the ethical situation, and the ethical situation was effectively disguised by the author. I mean, this is no idiot. So first thing, if you're going to make a $400 million film and you're going to take a worldview to the vast majority of teens in America, you're going to have to be really, really, really clever. And she was clever. This Suzanne Collins, or whoever it was that wrote this book that eventually became a screenplay, was very clever. First, the wealthier districts send the tributes to the games, and these tributes from the wealthier districts are semi-pros. They're less reluctant participants in the games. They're more aggressive. They're more involved. That's right. That one thing that makes it a little difficult. And when that guy comes after you and he's a little bit more in tune with what's going on, it appears that's going to be a little bit more of a self-defense kind of thing in this killing game.
And you start to feel sorry for the girl because she has to defend herself against these mean, angry brutes.
Then there's the fact that there are a bunch of them out there killing each other, and Katniss, the heroine of the story, doesn't have to do it right away. She just kind of runs away and tries to avoid the conflict at the beginning. But she also proves herself as a good person on the front end of the story.
By sacrificing herself for
her
sister.
That's right. She sacrifices herself. She steps in the place of her sister. Apparently her sister was 12 or 13. She's more like, I guess, 16 or 17. And so she steps in the place of her younger sister. And in the midst of this ethical smudge fest, okay, where it's really hard to know what's good and what's good and evil, and right and wrong. Here, Katniss tries to prove herself as a good person by making a good choice and stepping in for her younger sister and agreeing to join the Kill Fest in place of her younger sister.
And initially, that endears her to the audience.
It sure does.
So they think, she did this great thing, so she can do anything else.
That's right. Once she's done the good deed, she can do no wrong. She has to now beat the others at the killing game, and that's what she does. And in the end, she does kill. And she kills effectively. She's an effective killer. She kills one person by dumping a bunch of killer bees on this one girl, which may be
so it doesn't
one of the
seem
most,
as bad.
Well, it probably would have been one of the most torturous ways to die that I could ever imagine. I mean, this is imagine
being
somebody throwing
by thousands of wasps.
Tens of thousands of killer bees. I mean, these weren't just wasps.
Genetically
modified bad bees.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And she dumps this thing on this girl, and when you see her body, it's the most torturous way to die, I think, that anybody could ever use. And Katniss employs this in the murder of this little girl. And by this time, the audience is universally in support of the heroine.
Yeah.
Okay. And even at this point,
and I could feel myself.
I
being
began to see
of the girl.
Because she was being attacked by some of these people earlier on. Now they were sleeping at the time.
Yeah.
And it brings up the example of David.
Right.
Remember David? David was surrounded by Saul and his men. David could have engaged in self-defense. David could have attacked them in their sleep. Now, this is almost an exact replica of what happened with David and Saul. But, of course, biblical ethics don't tie into anybody's thinking today. So almost nobody, I mean, we're talking homeschoolers, Christians, kids who've been in Christian churches, they don't care about the Bible, and they're not going to apply any part of the Bible or any part of the Bible's ethical structures to what's going on the screen because they have such a dualism in their system. And as I'm watching this, I'm horrified by what's going on. You know, here these people are sleeping, and in their sleep, she dumps these bees right on top of them. And it's one of the most horrific murders I think I have ever witnessed in my life. Then she shoots another guy with an arrow, and she kills the last guy by tossing him to a pack of wild dogs. Again, I think genetically modified dogs, and they're probably some of those horrific things. And we had to turn our face from the screen several times.
Disgusting.
There was a point at which we had to do that. But you could hear his screams and his yells and so forth. But again, this is warming us up to murder. This is warming us up to the ethical decisions that tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of American kids are going to do when it comes time for the Nazis to kill the Jews, or for when the Americans need to kill the Jews, or for when Americans need to kill Christians, or whatever it needs to be, whatever it's going to be in the next 20 to 30 years. This is an excellent way. This is a tremendous way to prepare hundreds of millions of children, even Christian children and homeschool children, for the kind of murder we may see in the future.
And they'll do whatever it takes.
Yeah, and the thing that I think people don't understand, that we're so far away from a biblical ethic, that people now are trying to make it up as they go. In other words, they have no
basis at
all.
They're trying to make up morality.
Yeah, it's exactly what Peter Travers said from Rolling Stone magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You see, people just don't have any ethical
construct. You're all defining
it. That's right. You just make it up as you go. And so at the end, do you remember what happens? At the very end, the two survivors, and they're supposed to be, you know, teenage lovers. They kind of love each other in this little trice going on throughout the movie. At that point, they're challenged to kill each other.
And so they decide commit suicide instead.
To commit suicide instead, right.
Which is supposed to be somehow better.
Which is, again, against God's law.
Against God's law,
again, another horrific violation of God's law as they prepare to kill themselves. So they can murder each other, they can murder themselves. Effectively, they're violating the sixth commandment again and again and again and again in this movie. Now, the worldview of the movie comes out throughout. And you remember the 12-year-old innocent girl, she dies, provides the ultimate pragmatic ethic as she breathes out her last words to Katniss. Do you remember what
and
the words
she
were?
She says, you have to win.
That was it. You have to win. That's right. Those are the four words she used.
She basically is following the whole worldview of the empire.
Yeah.
She's not against it.
Exactly. She bought right into the worldview of the games, the worldview of the empire, and the pragmatic ethic. The pragmatic ethic. It's not you have to obey God's law. It's not you have to do good.
You have to win.
You have to win.
You're another cog in the wheel.
That's right. And you can do whatever it takes to win. You can break whatever part of God's law you want to to win. Now, as you think about this, Em, are you a little bothered by the fact that there are good little Christian girls and boys who watch these movies without their mom or dad around and without any kind of a very, very clear idea of what's going on, a clear interpretation of it, and a clear application of God's law to it? And they can be taken in by these things badly.
Yeah, Daddy, I am very bothered because I see this just in myself. If I had just gone down to the movie theater and watched it myself, I probably would have just sat there. And I would have had a little bit of pushback, but teenagers don't normally have the discernment that a lot of their parents do. And they don't look at these movies through the eyes of a biblical worldview.
Mm-hmm.
They're just looking at it as kind of like, oh, this is a fun night with friends. This is a fun movie. There's lots of sword clashing, and they're desensitized. I even am desensitized to this violence.
They're enjoying the popcorn.
Yeah.
They're enjoying the pop, and they're not thinking that they're turning into Nazis.
No, they're just opening themselves up and absorbing all of this.
Yeah. The worldview, again, and let's talk about the metaphysic for a second. That is the reality, the view of reality here. Is God involved?
No, not really at all.
But
They
take his name in vain. And who takes his name in vain?
The girl does.
The girl does,
the
right. That's right. The heroine has the foulest mouth of all of them, by far. She curses. She uses the word damn. She uses God's name in vain, and she's pretty much the foulest mouth.
She uses the most foul words
of the entire cast.
Entire
yeah.
Film.
So what's what is her religion? On the one hand, she shakes her fist at God. She's going to take his name in vain. So she'd take a moment and just shake her fist at God. So God shows up in the metaphysical. That's it. That's it, by the way. He's not seen as sovereign. He's not seen as one to be worshipped and obeyed and loved and believed in. You know, none of that.
Just
but
he is
cussed at. So there is that. There is the taking of God's name in vain on the part of the heroine. But she also has a religion. She has a religion. And that little religion shows up throughout the movie. Do you remember what it was?
She's very feministic and very self-centered in the way that she looks at, in the way that she looks at life. And it's all about...
Do you remember the amulet, though?
Oh, yeah. I remember the amulet.
The good luck charm.
Yeah, the good luck charm.
That's right.
She says, that's what's going to save me, is this good luck
charm.
That's
right.
Not
so
God.
Her religion is animistic. And that's what an animist is. The pagan Africans, when the missionaries got there, for the most part were animistic. And that's what this girl was. She's very pagan. I mean, she's like a pagan African if you were to show up in Africa in 1870 before the gospel made it there. These people are animistic. And that's what this girl is. She's got a little amulet. She believes in the force or the good luck involved in the amulet, all tied up in that material object. And she thinks that that's the thing that's going to save her. And at the end, she reveals it to the game show host. Do you remember in front of everybody when everybody's clapping and saying, yeah, you won, you killed everybody. You know, at that point, she shows her little amulet. And so once again, we understand the girl's religion. Also, they also talk about may the odds be with you. It's interesting.
Instead of may the gods
that's
be
right.
with you.
And there was a comparison to the Roman games throughout.
I think they actually said that.
They
the
did.
Roman games,
they did.
The gods
and when they
you.
Rode in the chariots, do you remember where they rode in the chariots?
Oh, that was very Roman.
Yeah, very, very Roman.
Games.
Extremely Roman, yeah. It was interesting that their clothing was not Roman. Their clothing was more Nazi.
Yeah.
So it was amazing that the black garments that they came out in really reminded you
very
of,
sterile,
of Nazis,
very,
yeah. So
very dark.
Certainly a preparation for sort of a Nazi approach in handling ethics. But the Roman connection was very strong throughout the movie. And when they say may the odds be in your favor, they're referring to not so much the gods that the Romans referred to, but a naturalistic, materialistic universe where there may be some kind of immaterial force, or at the very least, we live in a total chance universe where there's no possibility for absolute ethics, no possibility for any meaning, for any purpose in life. We're just simply cosmic dust floating around in a universe of pure chance. So that's their metaphysic. That's their worldview.
And they're just dust bumping into
that's
each
right.
other, killing
that's
each
right.
other.
Exactly. Now, Em, do you think that your average teenage kid in the audience tonight was thinking the sorts of things we've been talking about?
No, I don't, because I don't think if I had grown up by the grace of God in the home that I've grown up in, I don't think I would have been thinking of these things, because I wouldn't be looking at it from a biblical worldview and from how God has created me as a human being, and that life is precious because I was created in the image of God. Because if you're not created in the image of God, then there's really no reason for you to look at life as precious.
Well, they were looking at people as the same as animals. You remember that one point where she says, I can shoot animals? And then her friend said, well, it's no different between shooting animals and humans. Mm-hmm. You remember that? He said that. And that, of course, was the hero who said that to the heroine. No different, yeah. And they were the two that survived at the end. Again, the hero and the heroine agreed that there was no difference between animals or shooting animals and shooting humans. So, again, an absolutely grotesque statement made by the hero in the movie. Now, there were some weird inconsistencies in the movie. You noticed that in the village, the gender definition
was very strong.
Girls
in dresses.
That's right.
Boys in slacks.
That's right.
Short hair.
Short hair for the
long
boys.
Hair for
long
the girls.
Hair for the girls. The gender difference is very pronounced. But once you get to the battleground,
it's not.
Egalitarianism, baby. You lose it entirely. It's nothing but survival of the fittest. You can get a foot in the face of some girl, if you can beat her face in, so be it. That's the way it works. It's survival of the fittest. Get out there and you'd smash the face of some girl in. That girl smashes the face of some guy in. Yeah, there's no respect whatsoever for gender differences at all once you get into the battlefield. In fact, you notice they wore the same clothes as you looked at them as they were preparing to enter the arena.
They all looked the same.
Yes, same
kind
of thing.
And the guys were either these brute beasts that were just really aggressive and mean, or they were really wimpy, cowardly dudes that just succumbed to the whims of the aggressive lady.
That's right. And it was the girls, Katniss, who had all the strength, all the leadership, all the will to survive. Yeah, she was the one. And Emma, I think that's very, very sharp on the part of the lady and the producers who wrote and directed these films, because what they're saying is that the modern male is useless. He has no purpose. He has no will to live, to survive, to carry on civilization. The girl does, and that's absolutely true for the 21st century situation in general. We have a dying male culture in the modern world, and the female is out there in front just trying to make it happen. So, yeah, there were some weird differences there. There was also a tender scene where the body-mutilated homosexual was coaching the girl. Do you remember that?
He was the good guy. He was the really tender, sweet, loving gentleman.
So, again, it's exactly what a horribly defective, immoral culture is going to represent on the screen today.
The good guys are going to be the twisted
body pierced, body mutilated homosexuals. Those are the good guys.
That's your manly, chivalrous guy.
Now, what was also interesting, Em, about some of the clothing, I think we ought to mention, and the makeup in the big city, because there was a difference again between the big city and the village. In the big city, what you have is a really strange, postmodern, destructive, asexual, strange, nihilistic form of life.
It felt like looking at painted dolls' faces.
Very artificial.
Like they were all robots.
Right. Because modern man has become a robot. He's nihilistic. He is no longer a person. He's self-destructing, and he has no gender definition of any sort whatsoever. So, again, that's what you get in the modern city, and that's what you're getting more and more in the modern world, and I think a lot of people could relate to that who are watching the movie. The major evil, as defined by the good guy, and I quote this because I wrote this down. It is very important. The good guy was talking to the heroine, and he says, "I just want to show them that they don't own me. I just want to be me." Well, he says, "I'm okay with killing people. I just don't want people to control me.
I don't want people to force me to kill people. Yeah.
See? I don't want people to control me. I just want to be me. I want to make the choice myself. I don't want to subject myself to the controls of the tyrants." See, that was his major problem.
I just
want
to kill
problem.
Them. Because it's my
because
choice.
It's my choice to
kill.
Not because they're making me kill. Right.
I'm still okay with breaking
exactly.
the commandment.
Exactly. As long as I am the source of my own law. As long as I am making the choice myself. And that's the classic pro-choice argument for abortion. That's the way people live today. The hero is pro-choice, pro-abortion, pro-killing all the way, as long as nobody controls his choices. This is John Paul Sartre's existentialism. Makes it into almost every single humanist film that we ever see. You're going to see it. It's always the hero who's the existentialist, and he's going to make his own choices right. And that's the essence of what is good. And the ultimate evil is the fact that others are controlling you and controlling your choices and forcing you to kill others. If you could just make the choice yourself, that's all that matters. That's right. And the hero was very clear on this. One of the clearest existentialistic statements I've ever seen on the silver screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you've got to be very, very, very careful with that. Now, as we wrap up the program, ma'am, let's talk about what the Bible does say about the sixth commandment. I think this is very important. What does the Bible say? The Bible says that you shall not murder. You shouldn't kill. And murder is defined as hate in the heart, lying in wait. Also, we're not to kill in negligence. We're not to kill in a lot of situations. In general, we're not to kill except where the Bible allows it. Now, where does the Bible allow it? The Bible allows it in just war, which is carefully defined. Carefully defined in the word. And we even as Christians in the Army, in the Air Force, we have to be extremely careful that we're playing by God's rules, not just by the rules of a tyranny or some big republic or some big empire.
But
we have
God's
to continue
law.
Under God's laws. And we find the just war regulations all the way through the book of Deuteronomy here and there. And secondly, God's law allows for capital punishment for somebody who, say, commits murder, something like that. But two or three witnesses have to be involved. It has to be a true trial, and the civil government does it. The third thing is God's law allows for family defense. Family defense and home defense. Exodus 21 allows you to defend your home.
For a robber coming
and again,
into your home.
The Bible allows very limited opportunities for killing. Very limited. Extremely limited. The Bible has almost nothing to say about self-defense. I don't find anything about self-defense. Now, some people say there's a little room for self-defense here and there. The Bible allows for family defense in Nehemiah 4 and verse 14. The Bible allows for home defense in Exodus 21. So let's not get beyond what the Bible says. There's nothing substantial in the Word to be found about self-defense. Now, we have to be very careful that we're not allowing killing to go beyond the restrictions the Bible lays out for us, even if it's pragmatic. Even if it's, well, self-defense in this situation where somebody holds a gun to the head of your friend. Let's say somebody held a gun to the head of your friend. Let's say Sarah. You have a friend named Sarah. And somebody holds a gun to the head of your friend Sarah and says, here's a knife. Go kill Emily. Okay? Now, let's say, just for argument's sake, that Sarah is – now, should Sarah kill you? Under such a circumstance?
Should Sarah kill me? No.
No, she should.
No, she should.
You're an innocent person. You're a friend. You're a godly woman. This isn't an act of self-defense for her. This isn't an act of family defense. This isn't, you know, you're not
just an act
attacking
someone
the family, et cetera, et cetera.
Constrain her too.
That's right. And so she is not to kill you. But let's say she does. Let's say she comes at you. I mean, just in a weak moment, she just a little weaker than she should be. She's subject to this tyrannical person, this tyrannical system that's got a gun to her head saying, go kill your friend Emily. And she comes at you with a knife. Should you kill her now?
No, I shouldn't kill her.
That's
I should
right.
let her
you
kill me.
That's right. You should stand up against the evil that is trying to force you to break God's law.
And say, I won't break God's law.
That's right. That's right. You don't do it.
Yeah.
So now, do you think that tens of millions, hundreds of millions of little boys and girls watching that movie are going to respond that way when the Nazis put a gun to the head of these kids and say, you know what, I'm going to kill your family or I'm going to kill you unless you go and kill these Jews? Do you think that these people are going to respond in a good way?
No, I don't, Daddy. And I really think that the only thing that will bring people back to what's right when it comes to killing and to murder is knowing God's law and being discipled by parents and being discipled by people who know the law of God, which sadly a lot of our culture doesn't. And I was listening to some of the girls who had just come out of the Hunger Games showing, and they were laughing and they were going, oh, you know that part where that big dog jumped out? Oh, that made me jump out of my skin. And they were taking such light notice of all the murder and all the killing that happened in the film. And no, I don't think a lot of people don't take life seriously because they don't know what the law of God is.
And they don't believe in God.
No, they don't.
That's their problem. You know, here's what happens. You're in an ethically difficult situation, and that may happen. I mean, it may not be your friend coming at you with a knife. But let's say somebody does put a gun to your head and say, go kill those Jews over there, or go kill your friend over here. You say no.
Yeah, I could.
What do you think is going to happen when you say no? Is the bad guy going to shoot you?
He would shoot me, yeah.
Now, don't say that. You don't know
what's
going to happen.
Well, I don't know.
That's
yeah,
right.
I don't know what's going to
happen.
That's
right. The right answer is, I don't know what's going to happen.
But God knows.
That's right. Why?
Because God's sovereign.
That's right.
Over all of life.
That's right. God's in control.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? You know what may very well happen? When you say, no, I'm not going to kill my friend, you know what happens? God sends a meteorite out of the sky and it kills the bad guy.
That may happen. I don't know, and I'm trusting in
that's
God.
That's right. Because you know what? All things work together for good
exactly.
to those who love God mm-hmm. and live according to His word.
And to live as Christ, to die as gain. So
amen.
I don't have anything
so
to lose.
It's all going to work out for you.
Oh, yeah.
I just wish that more people would understand that. You know, the devil came to Jesus and said, kill yourself and I'll give you all this stuff. Kill yourself, God will save you. He challenged Jesus to obey God's law or to disobey God's law so that he would gain here and gain here and gain here and gain here. You know what Jesus came back with again and again? I'm not to break the law of God. I'm not to break the law of God.
Jesus,
I'm not to break the law
Jesus.
Of God. Even
said,
Jesus.
I will not break
against
the law of God.
That's right. That's right. And that's our responsibility too. And what bothers me is that these folks are dominating today. They're dominating our young people. They're taking the hearts of our sweet little homeschool families. And I think it's because there's just not enough discernment. There was not nearly enough discernment in families. I'm talking homeschool families and Christian families across America. I hope that hundreds of thousands of Christian families will download this radio program and talk about this sort of thing. Because you know what? We're not dealing with the Hardy Boys anymore. The top grossing films of all time right now are all about witchcraft, blood-sucking cannibals, vampires, situational ethics, killing games for kids. We are 100 years away from God's law right now. We're Germany in the 1920s right now. And unless Christians root and ground themselves in the laws of God and discern what's going on in the culture out there by the laws of God,
they'll get
we're in
sucked
trouble.
Right in.
That's
yeah.
Right. That's right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to a discussion between myself and my daughter. And I hope this has been helpful for you. Just a little insight on a discussion that we have as we walk, by the way, as we rise up, as we lie down, as we view the culture and try to understand the culture and react to the culture properly in the midst of a system where, man, people are being taken by this culture. I mean, like a tidal wave. And they just... It's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and they've got their kids in milk-bone underwear, and they run them into these movie theaters. Of course they're going to be eaten alive by this system. I'm very concerned, very concerned. May God have mercy upon us. And friends, you've got to be discerning. I would encourage you to get your children started in a proper worldview. It's one reason why I wrote the book, What Does the Bible Say About That? You know, that little book for 9-year-olds? I mean, it's so basic, Em, but I think it starts right there. I mean,
if
you could get What Does the Bible Say About That? It's a basic curriculum of worldview for 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 14-year-olds, 18-year-olds, 26-year-olds, 34-year-olds, 54-year-olds and 68-year-olds. It's 14-point font. I mean, it's really big font. So if you're 67 years old, you can still see it. And you can do the crossword puzzles and all the rest. But I would encourage you to get a basic worldview down straight. And get our book, What Does the Bible Say About That? Very, very basic summary of what the Bible says about everything. Available at our website, KevinSwanson.com. Pick it up today at KevinSwanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.
Always felt that doubt was the beginning of wisdom, and the fear of God was the end of wisdom.
Clarence Darrow.
The only true wisdom is knowing that you know nothing.
Socrates.
Belief is the death of intelligence.
Robert Anton Wilson.
If thou trusteth to the book called the Scriptures, thou trusteth to the rotten staff of fables and falsehood.
Thomas Paine.
Faith is believing what you know ain't so.
Mark Twain.
Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered.
God.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight.
God.
The fool believes his own ideas to be wisdom, but those who fear God and search for understanding find true wisdom. To lead your family in the pursuit of godliness, pick up a copy of the Proverbs Study Guide at generationswithvision.com.